The second part of this morning is quite related. Let me explain the two words in the title. Dynamics refers to the kind of slow dynamics from the buildup of mutation, selection, and population dynamics on the timescales that Alan was already talking about. And topology is the usual misnomer that evolutionary biologists have in the context of trees. So what we really mean here is properties of network graphs that emerge from the dynamic. And I'm going to focus about the link between topology and dynamics in these networks. I should mention this is joint work in our Berlin group with Ugo Pastola and Susana Mangrubia, who are now in Madrid, working at the Institute of Astrobiology, and Angelo Valeriani, a postdoc in Berlin. So this is the last week. We can start building up nostalgic looking backs, and this is my attempt at that. So we have come across networks in many contexts. Basically, 1.5 months ago, they showed up in many contexts at the molecular level. Transcription regulatory networks, networks of gene, as you would measure them from expression data, metabolic networks, networks of interacting proteins, networks of cells, and so on. And you can probably find at any stage in this sequence of scales something that you might call a network, up to our topic now, co-evolutionary networks of several or many different species. And it's largely an open question what are, on a statistical basis, the common grounds of these networks and what are their distinctive features. So one word that was the dearest buzzword in those molecular days was robustness. But it has been become clear through many of the talks that in order to make sense for this word, it really needs to be qualified. We need to talk about what kind of perturbation are we imposing on the system when we talk about robustness or sensitivity. Is it change in environmental condition? Is it mutations, deleterious mutations? Or is it change through co-evolutionary mutual adaptations? We need to talk about the kind, about the time scales at which these perturbations are operating. Are they slowly varying or rapidly varying? And last but not least, we need to worry about the size of these perturbations, because we have learned that robustness doesn't come for free. Whenever a system is robust to some changes, it pays with sensitivity and nonlinearities in other realms. The second word that popped up all the time was evolvability. So clearly, these networks are sort of there, so they have evolved. We don't really know how they have evolved, so we say it's due to some great property, which we call evolvability. And two papers later, you have a great theorem there. Biological systems are evolvable. And so I'm going to argue that for this work also to make sense, we have in the same way to quantify it. We have to ask what kind of dynamics are we talking about in order for systems being evolved or evolvable. And this talk will be largely about asking what kind of dynamics makes these systems evolvable. So species networks, in this sense, are interesting. First of all, they're interesting in their own right to ecologists. Issues like stability, robustness to perturbations are really issues in conservation biology. And these models that people make are really used as basis for decision making, say on environmental management and so on. And secondly, in this context of different networks, they are interesting as examples where some quantitative theory is emerging. And they really afford these two kinds of viewpoints. On the one hand, the ecology viewpoint, as Alan has already emphasized, on short timescales. So there we can ask about what topologies or shapes do these networks have, and people ask that. People focus on issues of stability and questions on robustness or sensitivity to various kinds of perturbation. On the other hand, you have the viewpoint of evolutionary biology on much longer time scales, where the issues are what are the dynamics, what kind of mutual adaptations shape these networks, and to put the famous buzzword here, are they evolvable under our dynamic rules? And what form does this evolution take? In other words, what are the speciations and extinctions that make up the time dependence of our networks? So here's a short flash at a kind of field data that Alan has already been describing for species networks, which come essentially from food webs. So a food web is a community of animal species in a sufficiently close environment so that you can send out your graduate students and measure all these kinds of things. So the food chains must be in some sense observable. So that's why lakes are very fashionable, because they are bounded. So you can sort of hope to get a fair fraction of the actual species that form part of the food chain network into actual observations. A trophic level of a species is then defined as some kind of average length of the downward chains. And clearly there are more than one possible definitions here. Alan chose the definition of the shortest path. They all derive from some kind of suitable average, and what you really want to do is to average the kind of path by their relative importance or by the energy flow that travels around them. So the shortest path comes from the assumption that probably most of the exchange between two species travels on that shortest path, but there are several probably equivalent definitions. The properties of food webs, the statistical properties of many large food webs are the following. There's a relatively small number of trophic levels, so you can't build up too many of them. There's a small number of prey species per predator, and then again that means the important prey species, and of course a species, as Alan already mentioned, is meant in a cladistic sense, so equivalent things are often grouped together. There are, as Alan mentioned, also few bottom species, many intermediate species, and only a few species at the top level, and that means that these networks really have a characteristic shape, and that's what we mean by it. So here is one of actually the so-called Pamlico food web. So there is all sorts of species. There are some species at the bottom that call level one, and there are some external resources. And in fact, it has four levels, and this is some kind of fish whose name you don't really want to know. And so that's the typical structure of such a food web, the solid arrows reflecting prey-predator relationships, who eats whom. And if you now plot the number of species, I'm going to come to the dashed lines. The number of species as a function of the level number, you find precisely this characteristic shape, a sharp incline at low levels and a decline again at higher levels. So clearly, that there's one more remark to make. If the Pamlico food web is what you're interested in, then this is it. Now, if you are not primarily interested in the Pamlico food web, then the issue arises, how does this kind of observation, which are necessarily in a relatively small closed environment, scale up to larger communities, maybe the whole set of species on a continent or on Earth? And that's really, to some extent, an open question, whether this is just a giant food web or whether there are sort of compartments that interact much more like in a small world network. In other words, if there are correlation links in larger systems, that's not quite clear.
This experimental figure level independence is the shortest path, right?
And this is, I mean, this is groups data from various authors, and every author has their famous, their most favorite definition. Some of them even, well, yeah, most of them use the shortest, or some, which, however, even if they say the shortest, it means some kind of, there is some kind of relevance criterion placed into it, which means really that they're doing some weight average as well. Excuse me?
Levels 5, 6, and 7, we've got non-zero values, but since the scale on
the
other side, they must be less than 1.
Well, yes, I should say that this curve is actually an average over a number of food webs that people have also performed. So most of them have just 4 levels, and which, so that's why.
Did they go 8 there? 0.
Yeah, it's probably a 0. Maybe that was one example with 8. I don't remember.
This is very part crucial in my mind. If you draw your picture, though, it will fall by the shortest thing, that fall would be a 3 already in the picture you draw.
Yes, so.
So that the long ones depend crucially on how you define whether an 8 is an 8 or really a 5 or 4, depends crucially.
Yes, so that's why it's the characteristic feature I want to focus on is what they all have in common is this sharp incline followed by a sharp decline. Again, there's no meaning to the actual absolute numbers. So,
isn't there an obvious definition which in terms of the amount of primary mass that takes to produce a given amount of biomass?
Well, that would be an integer. So people really want to sort of, at the level of the graph, observe some kind of grading. And that's to some extent independent of the precise definition. But you want to have an integer number that is a weighed sort of sum over the paths that go down. Well, I mean, yeah. In fact, if you do another sort of weighting, it becomes a... becomes a real number. So here's my slide on the population dynamics, and I want to focus on the type of Lotka-Volterra dynamics that Alan has been described. The simplest kind of population dynamics is well known. It expresses the relative changes of the population numbers as a sum of autonomous rates. They could be growth through external resources, species not included in the web. Because one important feature about these food web data is that they are by necessity incomplete. So we must allow in the description for, like in a renormalization group framework, for a number of degrees of freedom that are not in our explicit description. So here is external resources, death rates, and so on. Here is the influence of species J on species I, which may be positive or negative, and that the lowest order term would be a linear contribution to the growth rate. So that encodes predation, competition, symbiosis, and so on. I should say that these equations have been very well studied, as Alan has mentioned, for communities of just a few species, just in order to model these kind of behaviors, their evolutionary stability, and so on. And that's particularly important because the standing of these equations can be tested in those small systems. For example, in lab experiments like Lin Chao's experiments with viral systems.
The non-genericity of this two-variable polynomial derivation, in that scope, doesn't persist to many variables?
Excuse me, what doesn't persist?
The non-genericity of depending, you can have many stable, the marginal stability that comes in the simple polynomial derivation.
Well, we'll see that, in fact, if the system it depends very much. The properties of any kind of solution depends crucially, of course, what you choose here. We will see what we'll choose. That's small systems, they are well understood. And you have several possibilities of dynamical behavior, like limit cycles or chaotic and so on. For large communities of species, the main body of existing work is stability theorems for randomly connected network. But as Alan has already pointed out, they are probably very irrelevant for any kind of biological systems because these systems are far from random in many senses. So one motivation for sticking with a simple kind of dynamics, it's clear connection to strategic optimization in game theory. Namely, you can read the relative in this multi-species community, the relative population numbers, or rather their their relative fractions as a mixed strategy in some game. And the interaction matrix as a payoff matrix. And if you do that, then every evolutionary stable system in the sense of game theory is just a stable fixed point of an associated Lotka-Volterra dynamics. That associated Lotka-Volterra dynamics has the simple form expressing the growth rate of every species as a function of its fitness minus the average fitness. And that fitness is just given by the sum of the interactions with the other parts of the strategy. And the average fitness is just this bilinear form. That is just this average fitness just keeps the sum of the ni's constant. So this population dynamics is really generating strategic optimization. That's actually the main point of evolutionary game theory, that this reproductive success replaces rational thinking in order to obtain these optimas. That's what Peter Hammerstein was explaining last week.
Walter. Two species either are competitors or are cooperators. Couldn't it be both?
They can. In fact, well, at the level of this model, you would just, in this linear Lotka-Volterra setting, you would probably just add up the different types of GIJs that you would. Well, I'm coming to the sign and the symmetry properties of those in a second. So, in fact, on this slide, we want to take a little bit different approach from Alan's talk and ask what is the simplest kind of this dynamics that reproduces realistic features of these networks. And I've written down some answers here. The relative growth rate is expressed as a sum of the productivity and negative terms and the autonomous term. The productivity is just what you expect it to be. It's the sum of all contributions of food chains, of incoming food chains, with a positive sign. So here is some prey species for species I. So it's a link coming from below, plus the sum of all terms, summed over all predators of the species I in question. So J is here a predator. And those gammas are then by definition negative, plus the autonomous growth or decay rate. Then I have one term Ni, and that is the self-growth limiting factor of species I on itself. That's very well known for a single species. It just modifies the exponential growth, n dot equals n, to some logistic curve and leads to a saturation value. And I've normalized the n's here in such a way that these coefficients are 1. And then for consistency, I claim that we need to put in competition terms of a species with similar species. What similarity is, I'm going to define in a moment. And I will argue that these are an equally important part of the dynamics. So here is the competition load of the species I, not with itself, but with its similar species. And that's the sum of all other species times some coefficient beta ij, again multiplied by the population number. And that competition coefficient is some coupling constant times, or can be defined in this network as some coupling constant times the overlap of the two species. And one way of defining them is to just take the link overlap. So here is this is a vector of all the preys of species number I, all the preys of species number j, and we take essentially the scalar product of these two vectors suitably normalized. So that essentially counts the number of common prey, the relative number of common prey of these two species I and j, and we call that a competition link. So that's the second kind of interactions, and that's the dashed lines that you have seen already in the picture of the field data. Now, then we have, and we fix, I should say, of course, now for numerics, we fix these gamma ij, two values, gamma plus and gamma minus, respectively. If you come, all the prey links have a gamma plus, all the predator links have a gamma minus, and they are taken to be proportional to some overall predation strength gamma. So that's our first coupling constant. The competition strength is our second coupling constant. The autonomous rates are death rates that in fact turn out to essentially act as a cutoff, and we take them, for that reason it's permissible to take them equal. And so we have these three numbers. Now we have to impose boundary conditions on our systems. There's a boundary condition from below, the external resources that feed into the systems. They are taken as a small number of extra populations in quotation mark with a positive autonomous rate of the order of R. R is our sort of input parameter, and that's bigger than zero in distinction to all the species that have a death rate alpha.
Are there really two major things
here? We had the matrix Gij on the previous transparency that we are now decomposing into one predation part that are, well, maybe it's best I flash again this picture. Here, there's two kinds of propagators, if you will, between any two species, I and J. If there is a food chain, then that's a solid line, and it means a non-zero entry of the matrix gamma Ij, which is anti-symmetric. If they are competing, if they have a non-zero prey overlap, then there's a second kind of interaction signaling a non-zero beta ij and represented by a dashed propagator.
Okay, there is one parameter.
Well, except for this kind of efficiency parameter, so we could modify, we could replace the condition gamma ji equals minus gamma ij by gamma ji equals minus a constant times gamma ij. And so the second part, the dashed lines, are however symmetric. That's the competition. If A competes with B, B competes with A. So that's the decomposition of the matrix ZRJ we use.
Anti-symmetric gamma.
Yes.
But we found that lambda is quite important.
Well, in fact, it is important, and we take a value different from 1 for most of the representations, but the sign is the opposite. So let's see where I was. So as an example, so here, again, the three relevant parameters with these choices are just essentially and are very intuitively clear. It's essentially the network size given by the dimensionless ratio of this input rate R divided by, oh, I forgot to say that. There is an extinction threshold, so all species that get a population number smaller than some critical value NC, we count as extinct. So that's a representation of the fact that two small populations have a high risk of being not viable, be it as a result of greater sensitivity to adverse environmental fluctuations, be it for a higher mutation load. So that's built in this model just in the form of a cutoff at small population numbers. And then the dimensionless size parameter of our network is R over NC. There is the predation length and the competition strength. And in fact, R over alpha acts as a sort of equivalent cutoff. So for the purposes of this talk, you can identify alpha with NC.
How sparse are your metrics? How many zeros are in this initial input matrix gamma ij? Are there any zeros?
Well, it's reasonable matrices are rather sparse. We're going to see that. So here is a pedestrian's example, and I apologize for the near triviality of this slide, of what the competition term does in the simplest and, of course, textbook example of just two competing species. So here you have the two growth rates. That will be a fixed fitness or productivity, P1, P2. This is the damping term suitably normalized, minus N1, minus N2. And that is the interaction between the two equations, minus beta N2 and minus beta N1. And of course, you can immediately write down for the system the fixed point equations, which are linear. And as a function of the competition strength beta, you see, it essentially controls the window of coexistence. This is here the what's plotted along this axis is the ratio of the, that should read P, P1 divided by P2, the ratio of the two fitnesses. And if fitness 1 is too small with respect to fitness 2, only species 2 can exist. And then, of course, the fixed point value N2 star is just F2. In the intermediate value, if the fitnesses are rather similar or sufficiently similar, they both coexist. And on the other hand, for larger F1, only species 1 can exist. So as you tune beta from, if beta equals 0, the two species happily coexist because they have no overlap. If you tune beta to 1, then there are really two subpopulations for the, or they can be thought of as two subpopulations of a given species. So you have complete competitive exclusion. So only if their fitnesses are precisely equal would they be able to coexist? Even an epsilon difference would immediately drive out of one of the species out of business. So that is the sort of quantitative formulation that of what is already in Darwin's book, the mutual exclusion, the creation of diversity from niche formation. And then skip more comments on this at the moment. Now, of course, it's very clear that this population dynamics is not sufficient to say something about the shape of the system. As Alan has mentioned, we need to look at much longer time scales where the system changes, the payoff changes, the game changes. It's no longer game theory because the rules of the game and the number of players keeps changing as a function of mutations and the following selection. So here is what we do, which is in some sense similar to what Alan has described. We impose mutations on the system by an elementary step. We choose a species I, and we introduce a mutant I prime with a small population number of the order of nc that then can either grow or go immediately distinct. And that mutant I prime has either one link modified, its trophic properties are similar but somewhat modified from the mother species. Either one link is modified, the corresponding gamma entry gets a shift, or one link is added. So a new link, gamma ijk, gets a unit entry that was zero before. And then the selection acts via the subsequent population dynamics at the next time step. There are three possible cases. If the mother species I excludes I prime, then there is no change in the system. If I prime excludes I, you would call that a substitution, a mutation fixed by the selection process. If I and j can coexist, so if they are within the blue window of the previous transparency, we would call that a speciation. And the time scales we have looked at, although I should mention that this is not necessary, is the regime where the evolutionary time scale, that is the average rate of accepted changes in the system of fixations and speciation, is much larger than the relaxation times of population dynamics, which you could call ecological time scale. So these GIJ can be thought of objects that have a dynamics much slower than the NIs. So we could call them quenched random variables. So what really the time average at these long time scales is a quenched ensemble of Nash equilibria. Although one has to make, again, a caveat with respect to the network size. Whether or not this description is very good for very large networks, there are, of course, more mutations happen per unit of time. It depends precisely on the fact whether they sort of essentially, whether there's a natural correlation length so that different parts of the system relax independently, even though you have a mutation here and another mutation over there, or if they are all connected, in which case this ordering of time scales would at some point be questionable. So the results of this evolutionary dynamics can be summarized in just one sentence, essentially. It leads to, and that's going to turn out to be very important, to a broad distribution of biomasses and productivities. So if you take the point of view of a given sample or tracer species and you follow that process in time, you can essentially view it just as a stochastic process with an absorbing boundary. So if the biomass gets too low, the species is gone. And as a result of this stochastic process, there's a continuous threat of extinction for all species due to the ongoing competition. And that has sometimes been called the Red Queen effect. So let me show you just a three numerical diagram. One is the numerical productivity distribution normalized to the average productivity. You see that is a rather broad curve. At any, so that's the ensemble properties of the system. If you take
how does the productivity relate to the biomass?
It's a function of the population sizes. So it's a monotonous function of the population sizes. It's essentially the energy balance of the sum of the incoming predation links minus the sum of the outgoing predation links. And it's directly related to the biomass. This is going to come on the next transparency. You could also plot the biomass on the previous transparency, and you would get a very similar curve. So for the moment, take productivity and biomass as very closely related. So here is a tracer species that does this random walk, mapping out in a time average now what has been the ensemble average on the previous transparencies in this sort of sequence of Nash equilibria. And you see that this random walk here are the most sort of events in the neighborhood of that species are marked by dots. So here you have, for example, extinction of a prey usually makes the biomass go down. You have an accepted mutation of the species, which makes its biomass go up and its productivity. You have here a speciation, which makes the biomass go down rapidly because now the resources have to be locally shared with a highly competing species in the near neighborhood, so a species which still has high overlap, and so on. Of course, there are many non-local features of the networks that also add to a sort of background noise. Here's the same thing. Is the same thing on slightly shorter time scales, so you can essentially assess the same thing. So now let's come to topological or shape features of the resulting networks. Let me first take two sort of simplified cases where the solution can be worked out essentially analytically. A single food chain starting from level L equals zero to level capital L is always logarithmically short in this model, essentially because the biomasses decrease by a constant factor with respect to the previous level at every step. And so imposing the cutoff some a small population size cutoff NC, essentially this gives the length as a log of the population size at level zero, which is of order R, divided by NC, or equivalently divided by the constant alpha, sort of whatever is the more relevant part of this cutoff. The complementary viewpoint would be a single trophic level, sort of horizontal network. So here you have a bunch of resource terms and a bunch of species feeding off these resource terms, and they are labeled I equals 1 to S. I want to focus on the number of these species, which is a function, obviously, of the network parameters gamma ij and of the size parameters R over NC and R or alpha, which you can take essentially as equivalent parameters, and the competition strength beta. And now, the important point is that this species number remains bounded if the input size goes to infinity. So if your resources grow, you could think in abundance This could be fed into either an increasing number of species at constant biomass per species. This would be one sort of limit case, or into an asymptotically constant number of species with growing biomasses. It's obvious that the second case is much more favorable for complexity of networks, because those higher biomasses can then afford larger food chains on top of them. You see that? The size parameters, R over NC and R over alpha. So that's essentially our finite size parameter of the system. Excuse me? Yeah, the size of the resources, so which is a common size of like these terms over here. No, I mean they are variable, because we have these speciation processes. So they're determined by mutation and by speciation and selection. So whenever the system admits another species, the number of species will grow by one. If the selection doesn't admit it, it will stay constant. So,
right. So even the dimensionality that makes it
fixed. It shouldn't be fixed. It should be determined by the Darwinian process.
This is an analytic or a numerical result?
This you can make analytic statement. I'm going to come to this a line below. If you now focus on the consequences of this for a full network, you can even do some semi-analytic work, which you could call a self-consistent layer analysis, which essentially treats every of these layers on a mean field basis. So here you have the number of species at level L, which is a function. So, and here comes in the crucial input from the numerics or observations that, remember the, get a piece of chalk, remember the productivity was some broad distribution, followed some broad distribution. There's here a critical cutoff, and the number of species is essentially determined by the requirement that the probability of a species being present with p smaller than pc is of order 1. At that point, that's the stability threshold, and that's the criterion giving the number of species at a given level. And in the framework of this mean field assumption, this becomes then just a function of the average probability, which says sort of where the average of this curve sits, divided by NC, or this should read NC, or by the cutoff alpha, and the competition parameter beta. The overlap at level L is then a simple function in this mean field approximation, random predation to the level below. You can refine that in various ways. It doesn't change the results. Is a function of SL and the number of species at the level below. The productivity at level L is a simple balance between the input from the biomasses at level L minus 1 minus the loss to the species at level L plus 1. And finally, as I mentioned already, there is a direct and simple link between the biomass and the productivity. But let me not bother with writing out these equations, which are very straightforward.
I want to mention something very simple. So you have this two scenario, one single layer.
Yes.
Or you have one case where you have lots of species.
Yes.
And the other one is obviously much favorable.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I should have mentioned that. The two first cases...
You have as many layers as possible. Why?
Oh, yeah. The first cases were just constrained cases. So if I admit only a vertical chain, I can get an estimate of its length. If I admit only a single layer, then I can get an estimate of the species length. And the last, the layered mean field analysis, referred to a network which is sort of left to itself by the
dump. In your second case where you have lots of species.
On this slide?
Right, so you still have the option of having a few of these species and each one sort of eating lots of things.
Yes.
Different things. Or lots of species each just specializing in eating one of them.
Yes.
And you said that the one case is much favorable than the other?
Well, it's controlled essentially by the competition parameter beta. And real networks have this large amount of competitive exclusion. So I would argue that a finite amount of beta, a finite number of beta would be actually appropriate to describe that. I'm going to come to this on my next. So here you have the result of this kind of mean field analytic analysis. And you find indeed that the species numbers SL, they are strongly increasing for low L. That behavior coincides with what Alan has described for the more detailed model. And it's sharply decreasing at high L. That's, again, the model results for the number of species as a function of the level number, whilst the population numbers and the productivities are exponentially decreasing functions of L. And of course, like for various limit cases, you can do various analytic, you can write down various approximate formula. Essentially, what this describes is a crossover between two regimes of importance of interactions. At low levels, the number of species is what you could call competition dominated. It's not the amount of resources that's lacking for a species at lower level, it's just the number of available niches. At higher levels, the number of species is essentially becomes predation dominated, because as you move higher up in a level, there's just less and less food chains that can afford to have yet another species on top of them. So that sort of energy dominated limit at large length. And you can see from, if you look at this pattern, which has two different branches of the number of species versus L, that the minimum number of coupling constants in your model has to be 2 in order to describe this crossover from competition dominated to predation dominated in the species abundance.
Why do you use the word predation dominated? Is it just efficiency of transfer of energy rather than limitation by the predator?
Yeah, you could call efficiency dominated if you like that better. I meant the term in order to emphasize the contrast to competition dominated, but efficiency dominated is just as good a term.
Well, predation to me implies that predators are limiting the prey on the
meat,
which is not what
you're saying. Well, I mean, it's essentially the two kinds of arguments that we had in the two limit cases, that the length of a food chain is just limited by sort of the extinction barrier on the last level. Well, yeah, okay. I should have mentioned that is precisely the variations of the model for different values of gamma, and in particular for different values of the efficiency parameter. I don't want to go into detailed shape of these curves. The important point is the common feature that they all have these two dynamical regimes, competition and predation or efficiency dominated. The peak value is of course a function of the values of gamma and beta, the two coupling constant in the system, and or gamma plus and gamma minus and beta, and that gives for these different families of curves.
Do the ecological data though always peak at 2?
Well, they tend to peak. Well, we have already mentioned that the ambiguities in the definition, but they tend to peak at a low level 2, and then of the order of 2, and then they have, most of them have only 4 or 5 levels, and they go down again. So, excuse me? Well, this mean field analysis, and I should mention, if you run the system numerically, you get something very similar. This mean field analysis just takes one important input from the evolution, namely that the distribution of biomasses is broad. And that, of course, is a consequence of this underlying stochastic process, which imposes a random walk on every species and its productivity. So never is a species at rest at a good value of the productivity. It's always subject to changes due to the changes of the other species, and therefore it will eventually hit the absorbing boundary at some point. So conclusions. Well, let me state the obvious again. Darwinian networks are far from randomly connected. There is this clear layered grading, which is it's very different from a randomly connected network. Their shapes are formed by the underlying dynamics, and that's the link we wanted to get at between the dynamics, which is the population dynamics on shorter time scales that embodies selection in the Darwinian sense, and the mutation speciation dynamics that has random characteristics. Those together determine the shape. And so in turn, you can hope to read off from shape or topological characteristics, maybe more local ones or finer ones than the ones we've looked at so far, read off characteristics of the underlying dynamics. So there is an inverse problem here. So what could be the simplest Darwinian model interaction? I would claim you need at least two basic interactions of the system in order to get this kind of Darwinian networks. The first and obvious one is predation, giving rise to links between species that, in a physicist's language, you could associate with transport of energy. So what's the second one? That's this explicit competition between species that is the quantitative formulation of the existence of different niches, leading to mutual exclusion of species, and thereby allowing complex networks to grow. So in physicist terms, I'd like to think of the second term actually as something like Fermi statistics. Just as two fermions don't like to be in a state close by, and this Pauli principle generates chemical diversity, you could say that the explicit niche competition leads to an exclusion principle generating diversity of species networks. Without that, you could have lots of networks with lots of species at level one, essentially all in a Bose ground state without any complexity, because none of the biomasses would grow big enough in order to afford and support longer food chains on top of it. And lastly, so this is our perspective on what we are working now, you can look at this dynamics, and this is maybe a more interesting set of issues, on a local scale. Now, if you believe you have a model that says something about the interaction of species, you can study its connection of the local dynamics. If a species speciates and then goes on as two daughter species, and so on, with the underlying genealogies and evolutionary trees that this dynamics generates. And very little is known about how trees look for strongly interacting networks. In other words, how the dynamics of the species interactions, the trophic interaction, translate into topological and graph features of trees. Lots is known for trees generated by neutral evolution, but this strongly non-neutral evolution will generate trees that are very different from those. And that's actually a hope to make a new correspondence to data, because tree data are abundant and are growing, and it should be possible to then infer from data and the resulting tree shapes something about the underlying dynamics. So there's a new window of correspondence of these long-term processes with actual data coming up from these various genomic analyses that are going on at the moment. Thank you. Well, that's if you locally there will be there are independent parameters, because we are in this quenched limit we introduce one change sort of per unit of time scale. So if R is just the size of the underlying resources, so that's the in the end that will not control the size, the number of species. Yeah. So if you talk about if you make the number of species bigger, then that's precisely there will be more. Well, there will be more mutations, but also the fixation probability will be lower. So so that would mean that there should be no correspondence. However, it's what these kind of models deal with is sort of the rare and mutations that are selectively favored, not the disadvantaged mutation. So not much is known about sort of their frequency, and you can work out their fixation probability at a function of population size. But these are anyway sort of a sequence of very rare events compared with the deleterious mutations that make up sort of the mutation load of a species. So this should be anyway two different time scales.
I wonder how many evolutionary stable strategies are there for a given matrix gamma and j. I mean, suppose you take a random matrix with a given number of non-zero elements, and now you try to run it through this, you know, most simple equation analog of Bandera. How many evolutionary stable strategies you can find? Will it exponentially grow with the size of the matrix, or how it depends on the sparsity of the matrix?
Well, I think that the important point is that here that these systems, they're grown from a very different initial condition. So they are, we start sort of with one species, and then the complexity is built up. So it's a very sort of specific initial conditions, and then the complexity is built up. I don't know what sort of, you can probably make a quite different set of statements, say for random matrices, or even if you start with a system from a random matrix and then let selection act. But that's also, that would be, from this point of view, it would be a highly artificial initial condition. So there could be many, I don't know. It depends certainly, it depends on the type of initial condition that you impose and on the kind of dynamics. And, yeah, Johannes.
And it persists for any sparsity of the matrix.
And there's lots of results for random matrices, of course. Yeah, Walter?
This is a very formulated question, but have you thought of applications where these logs do pronounce?
not explicitly. I think I had a discussion with Stefan the other day. You could probably make cases for the types of interactions for the population dynamics part in a similar way to be present in economic systems. I'm not sure how the mutation and speciation process would translate. So there may be, it might be that the selection part has these two components as well, and the underlying sort of random part could be different. But there probably is some kind of application, but I haven't thought about it in detail. Okay, time for lunch. Now I must switch role again. You've probably seen the email. There is an additional talk tomorrow afternoon, which is not on the program. Tony Z will talk on field theory and RNA folding.